I want to start by saying it's actually a shame that we have to be here today. People might have seen, as recently as a couple of weeks ago, it looked like Labor might have this whole housing crisis thing stitched up. Jacinta Allen called an emergency housing summit. She was looking for, quote, an ideas factory to generate ideas to solve the crisis. Positive indeed. I started to worry a little bit when I didn't get an invitation. No one I know got an invitation. The Emergency Housing Summit was held this past week, and the attendees, of course, were a veritable who's who of the very great and wonderful property minds that have delivered us into this crisis. And the ideas factory that they were so keen to get together generated really spectacular ideas. So, one, tax cuts for developers. Streamlined approval processes for developers. Opening up more government land for developers. And this morning, people might have seen that we woke up to the news that actually just like 500 metres from here, a prime piece of public land that has sat vacant for years on end while the government has been promising to build what's really a second-rate form of social housing, community housing, and then a bit of affordable housing. They've scrapped that now, and that public land is going to be sold to developers to build hundreds of, at-market homes. So the very sorts of things that have brought us to this moment, the government will be delivering us more of. And I've worked in housing and rental issues for 15 years or so now, and I can't remember a time when we haven't talked about a housing crisis. There's never been a moment in this work that I've been like, geez, it's great to be a tenant. So easy to get a house. So in a way, I think calling what we're experiencing now a crisis just doesn't really sort of meet the scale of where we're at. So, thesaurus, but better words, I think, nightmare, absolute disaster. There is something quite distinct going on right now. It is quite different to how it's been, as bad as it has been in years past. It's different now. So rents have increased between 20 and 30% over the last 2 years alone, which is just extraordinary. I'm sure many people here experience that on a weekly basis. And what it means is that you can easily spend 40, 50, 60% or more of your income on just keeping a roof over your head. It means being afraid to ask for repairs or to daring to enforce the minimum standards. And it means being evicted just flat out if you can't pay your rent. The only limit to rent increases under the law brought to us by the Victorian Labor government is the market. How weird and circular. So as long as your landlord, you can pitch your profiteering at exactly the same rate or roughly the same rate as the other landlord's profiteering, you're 100% good to go. So this is obviously a boon for residential property investors, but so too for another sector of the economy, self-storage. Now that I've mentioned it, you will not be able to unsee it. The number of warehouses that you will see popping up all around here even. It used to be they'd be out in the sort of boondocks, but there's such big money in it now. They're building self-storage warehouses in the inner and middle ring. It will make you angry because you will see them all the time now, and angry that we live under a system that cannot provide every person with a home. But it's a system where this failure to meet a basic human need, shelter, creates a market for another parasitic section of the economy to extract a profit. So the self-storage market is having a boom. This is from an industry publication. Gen Z users are one of the larger occupiers due to changing housing trends. A strong residential market has many occupiers needing to reduce their household footprint. It's a cool way of saying being evicted, due to increased rents. As a result, having less space for belongings. So translate that. Younger people are often unable to find or hold on to affordable housing. When they get evicted from one place and can't find another quickly enough, they need somewhere to keep their stuff, and we will charge them for that right. The good news is, they say, this is a trend unlikely to dissipate. Difficulties in securing rental properties is leading individuals to seek alternate places to store their belongings for extended periods. Good times. But look the other way and you see a different type of parasite making hay from this crisis. Rooming house owners. Rooming houses are often also described as boarding houses. The shared accommodation, you get a room, maybe a kettle, maybe a fridge, and you have a shared kitchen and shared lounge room and shared bathrooms. Increasingly not even a shared lounge room. All the spaces are just turned into bedrooms. If you live in a rooming house, the ABS counts you as homeless. And that's because even the ABS know that to count as having a home, you need to have more than simply a roof above you and walls around you. You need security, you need privacy, and you need space, somewhere that you can live a meaningful life and not just exist. But we are witnessing a boom in rooming houses. So another industry mug. This is them. It's all demand driven. There's demand for this product in the marketplace. They do have great yields. Boarding house landlords are making double the ordinary rental yield. The calculation is simple. You can cram more people into each dwelling, sometimes multiple beds to a room. So the reduction in one person's living standards is another person's attractive yield. Whereas when I started working in housing, rooming houses were often run by shady underworld adjacent figures. And some still are, certainly. There's a new hedge fund adjacent style rooming house operator entering the market. Rooming house landlords like Frank Days, who runs a property development company called the Social Housing Collective, whose website promises to share the rooming house money making strategy with any smart investors interested in extracting profit from human misery. So this is Frank. We don't sell property, we realise dreams. In these times of uncertainty, where others see impending doom, we see opportunity. As Warren Buffett says, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. So the greed that Frank espouses in response to is the fear of others, the fear that others have of sleeping in cars, couches, on couches, and of course, rough sleeping. And it's the reason why last year there were between 500 and 600 boarding house applications before Sydney councils. In Melbourne, you don't even need a council permit to build a rooming house, so it's harder to track. But we know between the 2016 and 21 census dates, the number of people living in rooming houses in Victoria doubled. And the next census is 2025, and I expect it will be similarly disastrous figures. Disgusting though the private rooming house market is, peddling this form of homelessness is no longer the sole purview of the market. Most people here will be familiar with one of the key dynamics in non-market housing, as it's now called, in Victoria, and that's the growth of community housing and the shrinking of public housing. One of the key ways that community housing, which is run by dozens of different private not-for-profits subject to light touch regulation, if anything at all, one of the key ways they've been integrated into the system is by combining the public housing waitlist with the community housing waitlist. So it's one big list now, except that it's not called a waitlist anymore. This is a bit of an aside, but I think it's worthwhile. It's not called a waitlist anymore because in my view, I think they know that to call it a waitlist implies that you should expect something at the end of it and that there might be an end of it. It's called a register. So it's the Victorian Housing Register. Making an application is now called registering an interest. So you're invited to register an interest in not being homeless. As another aside, it's a register because when it was a public housing wait list, when your name got to the top of the list, you got an offer. Need and urgency were relevant considerations, but when you got to the top of whatever list you were on, you were made an offer. As it operates now, community housing providers have access to the entirety of the register and can take people from wherever they sit and on whatever basis they want. And if you think about social housing rents generally being calculated on the basis of people's income, who's a better looking tenant, someone on Newstart or someone on DSP? So you'll see that overwhelmingly the people that get taken off the list for community housing are people who are receiving DSP. Absolutely in need of housing, no doubt. But certainly it's not a system that operates on the basis of transparency and equity. That is an aside, important though it is. But so someone on this combined register can now be offered public or community housing. What's not very well known is that if you're offered community housing, there's a not insignificant chance, particularly if you're single, that you'll be offered a room in a rooming house. This is because community housing providers, unlike the government, which provides public housing, operates rooming houses. So remember, a rooming house is a form of homelessness. This is one of the not often spoken about effects of the growth of community housing and its merging onto the public waitlist. You can now exit the social housing waitlist into a form of accommodation defined as homelessness. And before you say that can't be true, surely it's transitional. You come off the list for a little while you're in this, and then you're still on, and then you get wait until you get offered something that you actually live in. That was my thought the first time someone came through the doors at work saying, "I've just been taken off the list and I'm in a rooming house." We're like, "What? Nah, can't." 100%. So you come off the list, you lose your spot on the list in a form of accommodation that is technically homelessness. And you can understand why. The money stacks up in exactly the same way for community housing providers, which again charge rent on the basis of income, whether or not you're living in a room, in a rooming house, or a flat, or a standalone house. They're taking 30% of your income. Okay, so public housing. Public housing is chronically underfunded and has been for about 40 years. Year upon year, the stock shrinks. Sans a tiny little construction blip around 2007, 2008, when the Rudd government was dumping money into the economy in response to the global financial crisis. Many in this room will know these figures because we talk about it a lot, but also it's not just socialists and progressives that are now talking about the importance of social housing. But Victoria has the lowest proportion of public housing of any Australian state or territory by a really long margin. And of what stock it does have, it also has the highest vacancy rate. And this sounds crazy. How can public housing in the middle of a housing disaster be vacant? But indeed it is. 7% of Victoria's public housing stock is vacant, and that compares to 1 or 2% in other states. And this is because we know that for a number of years, the Victorian government's favoured public housing strategy is to empty it, demolish it, and bring in developers and rebuild some form of community affordable and straight up market housing on that land. So there are thousands of public housing properties sitting vacant while they're in this privatisation pipeline. The privatisation pipeline, if you're talking to a Labor member, is also known as the big housing build. What has it netted us in additional social housing dwellings since they started down this path in 2018? It wasn't called the Big Housing Build in 2018, it was called the Public Housing Renewal Program, but it all started in 2018. How many additional social housing dwellings do we have as a result of all of the huffing and puffing that we've seen over those many years? And the number is 74. Oh. And that's 74 additional community housing homes, and God knows how many public housing homes that we've lost. So that's 6 years, thousands of people displaced, and 74 additional community housing homes. And as I say, there's a lot of huffing and puffing about this. It's a huge smoke and mirror for the fact that the public housing system is being gutted, meaning there's absolutely no fallback for those squeezed out of the market. Were it not so, the greed of people like Frank Days would have to be muted. It's a lot harder to charge $300 a week for a room in a rooming house if Frank Day's market is able to secure themselves stable public housing instead. And the piece de resistance of the attempted destruction of public housing, which is handing over every vestige of housing provision to the market, is of course the decision to demolish all of Melbourne's high-rise flats to be replaced with, we actually have no idea what. So we know 100%, I mean, we don't know, they haven't said so, but I would bet my meagre life savings that there'll not be a skerrick of public housing, there'll be some community housing, and there'll be a whole lot more private housing. Weirdly, what we do know is how many Repcos and Bunnings they think they can fit on the sites, because one of the things that they did do and have made public inexplicably is the assessment that they asked one of the big accounting firms to do about how much commercial stuff can we fit on these estates. And they've sort of brass tacked it down to the type of shops that you'd have on there. So we have a bit of a sense of their vision there. Okay, so the point of going through some of these examples isn't just to revel in the horror, but to start to make the argument that the crisis we're in is not some accident. We are where we are because of the political decisions made of successive governments, because of neoliberal policies and a market that's doing exactly as it's intended to. And you can tell that this is how it's all supposed to be operating, because the Frank Days of the world, the storage kings, the places these are the quotes I provided are the first results that came up in a Google search. There's like dozens after these ones. None of this is hidden. these are not outliers. These people are doing God's work, and they feel no qualms about sharing what they've learnt. Affordable, secure, accessible and well-maintained housing is counterposed to an unregulated and booming housing market. And a booming housing market in this country is fundamental to what's called the health of the economy, that is, profit margins for asset owners. Ensuring that housing remains the protected commodity in the market that it is good economic management according to the people who run our system and those who benefit from it. Which explains why those who run capitalism do not have any genuine interest in affordable housing. And I use affordable housing in the actual sense of housing that people can afford to live in and live well in, and not in the government sense. When they say affordable housing, they mean if you're in Metro Melbourne, housing that is 10% less than the market rent and no more than 30% of the median income, which is likely more than any of us earn. Bizarrely, if you live in regional Victoria, affordable rent is no more than the market rent. So, cheers. you can't be charged more than that. Anyway, so know that when they talk about affordable housing. Anyway, which explains why they subscribe to the imperative to keep house and rent prices high. Now, that's not to say that for governments it can't get a little bit uncomfortable, a bit politically challenging, which is clearly where we are right now. Ideally, they want the market to operate as expected, for us all to pay up and shut up, and for those who can't cut it in the market to be marginalised as losers and layabouts. But rent rises of 30% over 2 years, lines down the street at rental inspections, homelessness services closing their doors just because of the sheer volume, and whole generations of people who 100% think that they will never own a home, that happy balance for the government starts to look a bit askew, and it's hard to hide it. But what do they have to offer? A bit of tinkering with rental laws, doing nothing, touching nothing about the market. So an example will be on rent increases. So a couple of years ago, the government made it so that landlords can only increase rents once a year. Zero limitation on the size of those increases. And that's brought us 20 to 30% increases. Shared equity schemes, another thing I like to talk about. So this is the government chipping in some of the cost of overinflated housing prices, which helps get some people into the market while propping up high prices. Similarly, increases to rent assistance. Again, the government chips in a chunk to pay your rent, not nearly enough to meet the increases that people are actually dealing with. But what they effectively do is throw money at landlords so that that's to keep the investor profits flowing while doing nothing to limit those increases. So what do we think we should do? So to start where I ended in the horror tale, we need a mass public housing build and a huge upgrade of existing housing stock. That's one of the elements that's not spoken about as much as the other. We need thousands upon thousands of new public housing homes. But one of the scandals is that people who currently live in public housing are quite likely to be living in uninhabitable conditions. So mould is a big feature. Significant overcrowding is a big feature. And significant overcrowding as well is defined as homelessness. So some people living in public housing are defined as living in homelessness. So we want a significant build of new homes, and we want an audit of all existing homes and any work needed to retrofit existing homes, towers, standalones and walk-up estates. So what's a mass build look like? Some of the charities in housing say call for 6,000 new social housing homes per year because they're quite happy for it to be community housing over the next 10 years. I mean, that seems wild given that we've just got 74 additional homes over about 6 years. But even that will only clear the register over the next 10 years if a single new person doesn't sign on. So Victorian Socialists, over a decade, we want to do more than just house those currently on the list. We're calling for 15,000 new public homes per year for at least 10 years to get people housed more quickly and to undo the decades-long deliberate strategy to shrink the proportion of non-market housing in this state. We want to reassert the demand that housing is a right, and this means a mass expansion of the only form of housing that currently undermines market imperatives. Victorian Socialists want to scrap the sickening tax benefits accruing to landlords, principally negative gearing. which goes overwhelmingly to the rich. 50% of the benefits going to the richest 10% in society. And it's staggering what the value of this tax concession to the rich is. Over the next 10 years, these are the government's own figures, $100 billion over the next decade, $100 billion over the next decade will go to landlords for simply, accruing wealth through property hoarding. $100 billion. I mean, I did a little comparison to the submarines, because people talk about submarines and the hundreds of billions. The submarines are like a few billion each. So this is just immense. Victorian socialists want to end the practices of land banking and property hoarding. Some people who own properties are rich enough that they don't even need to collect rent on them. They sit empty for years, growing in value. The owners then sell and take their capital gains tax concession. That's worth about $50 billion. Over the next 10 years, and realise a profit from owning an asset in the shape of a house, but whose purpose is not to provide someone with shelter, but only to generate wealth for its owner. Okay, so what's this got to do with council? Because technically we're here for a council-based campaign. Councils can't do some of this stuff, but there's plenty that councils can do. We've come up with a few ideas, and if Victorian socialist candidates are elected, we'll direct council offers to help us come up with more. Some of the things that we've thought about that make sense to us, differential rates policies, something that exists already. So council treats different types of properties differently in terms of rates. It's just not novel and it's not weird. What we say is that it should be based on how the property is used. So we think people should pay more if the property is vacant. So if you're land banking, if you're hoarding, you should pay a penalty rates. Likewise, we think there's capacity to require people to pay penalty rates if they're a landlord and they increase rents of the property. We want to establish a rental task force. So this is something that would take the burden of enforcing minimum standards, possibly issues to do with rent rises, away from the tenants themselves, and puts it in an external body. We would argue for the state government to give councils and those task forces enforcement powers, so that we could, at the council level, issue penalties to landlords that won't do repairs, won't maintain minimum standards. We could also establish a name and shame list. So we'd be inspecting properties. When I say we, the council task force would be inspecting properties. I'd love to do it, happily apply for that job. And we could potentially establish a name and shame list for dodgy landlords in Darabin. If we were elected to council, we would argue for others on council to be a loud and unceasing advocate for more public housing and against the profiteering that pushes people out of Darabin. As soon as we heard about the goings on at the block down the road, Kat got down there, shot a video to get the word out there. It'll be interesting to see what happens next week. We've called on Darabin Council to come out strongly against the proposal to sell off this prime land, and we've called on them to argue with the state government to reverse that decision. We shall see, but that's the kind of thing that we would absolutely be doing if we were on council. But, and this gets to the core of Victorian Socialists as a party, we're not only motivated by achieving this or that policy or regulation change, important as they are, and we have a whole website with a whole suite of housing policies. We want to be part of political struggle that confronts the system that has delivered us this crisis. Any elected representative of Victorian Socialists at any level of politics will be a part of and a voice for any campaign that's attacking the root of this problem, be it right now to defend the public housing towers and demand a mass build of public housing, or a movement challenging the property hoarding and profiteering of the rich. We don't have the sort of movement that can turn this political inconvenience into an out-and-out crisis for the government and the rich, but wherever people are fighting back, Victorian Socialists will be there. Because it's only by being part of a movement that can challenge capitalism that we have any hope of winning a world where no one worries about where they sleep, and where our homes are not something we even particularly think about. We take them for granted while we're going about creating full and beautiful lives.